Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true?
They don't think Christianity's true.
They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
Ladies and gentlemen, what evidence for God is the most obvious to all people, yet the most resisted? What evidence for God is on the inside of everyone, yet it's continually suppressed? I mean, we know it's there, but we want to keep it in the closet. We want to hold it down. This evidence for God is essential to your temporal success and also your eternal destiny. You must accept this evidence and embrace it, or you're going to reduce the chances you're going to be successful in this life and completely void the chance that you're going to be with God in the next life. What is this evidence? We're going to the phone lines very quickly today. Our phone number is 888-589-8840, 888-589-8840. And this evidence that we're going to talk about today, I probably get more pushback on this evidence on a college campus than anywhere else, this particular argument for the existence of God. Yet everybody knows it. Everybody knows this evidence. Every culture knows it. In fact, every culture expresses it. And yet, every culture, individuals within the culture suppress it. What is it? What evidence for God is the most obvious yet the most resisted? 888-589-8840. I'd love to see what you have to say about it. Because we all know it. We all have it. We all have to live by it. And yet there's probably nothing more resisted. There's nothing more suppressed. And in fact, if there's one thing that keeps people out of the kingdom more than any other, it's this. And yet we all know it. We all know deep down in our hearts this is true. Yet we don't want to admit it. We don't want to admit this. We want to go our own way. And so, as C.S. Lewis said, our greatest sin is the sin of pride. Because we want to do our own thing. We want to go our own way. And we know that this evidence gets in the way. What is it? Does anyone want to take a shot at it? The phone lines are open. 888-589-8840. No, I don't want to talk to you, Frank. I don't want to talk to you today. If you guys don't call in, I'm just going to tell you what it is. But that wouldn't be as much fun. I want to see what you think it is. In fact, when you think of your friends and relatives who are not Christians, why are they not Christians? Is there no evidence for Christianity? Some atheists will say, of course there's no evidence. Or is there evidence against Christianity? Of course, some atheists will say, well, of course there's evidence against Christianity. That's what they'll say anyway. But this evidence is really undeniable. Everybody has it. Everybody knows it. But we don't want it. We want to suppress it because we want to go our own way. So what is it? Now the phone lines are lighting up. I want to get your insights as to what you think this evidence is. In fact, there are at least a couple of famous Christian apologists, probably more than a couple, but there's one that I'm thinking of right now that is probably the best at this, and he considers himself this kind of apologist. He uses this argument more than any other. What is it? Well, let's see. Let's go to the great state of Oklahoma, and we'll start with Kenny in Oklahoma. Kenny, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead, sir.
Good morning, Frank. Are you referring to the conscience of man?
Well, Kenny, you get the prize. Yes, I am referring to the conscience of man. And what made you say that?
Well, because you're so right. We all have a conscience. We do know what's right and we do know what's wrong when we reach that age of accountability. And we need to remember that the Bible refers to those who, because they keep sinning and turning their back on God, they end up with a seared conscience, and God forbid that we end up there That's basically a reprobate mind. And another scripture speaks of being past feeling, where you, because of your sinful rebellion, you quit feeling the conviction of God and you sear your conscience, sir.
Yes, well, Kenny, I think you've nailed it, and that's that doesn't add much tension to the rest of this show now. Well, we're going to talk about it a lot. You get it right off the bat, Kenny. You're absolutely right. I think Romans chapter 1 deals with this most directly when actually he starts, as you know, in Romans chapter 1, he starts with one other obvious piece of evidence that God exists, and that is the creation. As you know, he starts right there, and he talks about that God's invisible qualities are clearly seen so that we're without excuse. We know that there's a creator. You see, we know God by his effects. We see a creation, so we know there's a creator. And then he talks about people suppressing the truth about God so they can do their own thing, go their own way. He gets into morality right there in Romans chapter 1. And as you pointed out at the end of Romans chapter 1, some people have gone so far down the immoral road that God has given them up to their own desires, and now not only are they doing evil things, they're encouraging other people to do evil things, which really I think we see in our culture more now than at any other time in our culture. We're not only tolerating evil, we're approving evil and celebrating evil. And then, as you know, in Romans chapter 2, Paul expressly talks about the law written on our hearts, and we all have it. So great call, Kenny. You're absolutely right. 888-589-8840, 888-589-8840. And if you'd like to comment on it, we're going to talk the entire program about this, the moral law. That is the evidence for God that's most obvious yet most resisted. I mean, the creation is obvious too, but it's not as resisted because there's a lot of people who will believe in a creator, but they just don't want a moral creator. In fact, you will believe this. I'm writing a new book right now, and I'm researching the new atheists quite a bit. Of course, the new atheists are people like Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss and Sam Harris and, of course, Christopher Hitchens, who has since passed on. And most of those men, in fact, all of them, have admitted that you could make a good case for a deistic God. What's a deistic God? That's a God who is a creator, but not necessarily a moral creator. He creates the universe. He sets up the laws of nature, but then he leaves it. He's not involved in human affairs. There are no miracles. He doesn't care what we do. He's not a moral, authoritative kind of being. He's just a creator and a sustainer. Other than that, he's not involved, okay? Now, why would these men be open to that kind of God? A creator God, but not a moral creator God, not a God who creates and has moral demands. Well, because morality gets too close to home. We don't want that kind of God. And many atheists have admitted this. They don't want there to be a God like that. They want to go their own way. And let's be honest, people, half the time we're like that too. And when I say we, I mean if you're a Christian, you don't want there to be a God in that sense either. You want to do your own thing. It's inconvenient to have a moral being out there. We want to go our own way. So why it's obvious that there's a creator, it's also obvious there's a moral creator, and yet more people resist the moral creator rather than just the creator. Atheists are open to deism in many cases, but they're not open to a theistic God, a God who not only creates the universe but is involved in it and has a moral standard. He actually is the moral standard. That's what we suppress. And I submit to you that most of the time when we get into trouble in this life, it's because we've ignored the moral law. We want to go our own way. You know, sometimes things happen to you have no control over. That's quite obviously true. You can get into trouble that way. But more often than not, the trouble that we experience in our lives are made by the moral choices that either we make or people around us make. And what we're doing is we're suppressing the truth. And we're going to get back to your phone calls after the break. 888-589-8840. 888-589-8840. You want to talk more about this? I mean, we're in a new year. You want to make a New Year's resolution. You may want to try and follow the moral law through the grace and strength of Christ. Back in just 2 minutes. Don't touch that dial.
Back in 07, my father passed away. My mother had passed away 7 years earlier, and they left me a small inheritance, and I wanted to give back to AFA for all they have done for me.
Carol talks about her experience with the AFA Foundation.
I am an avid listener to AFR, 12 hours a day, and I hear Dan Celia talking about the charitable gift annuity. So I liked what the gift annuity offered, called Diane O'Neill, donated a certain amount, and from that, I get a check every month, which is retirement income for me. It's as simple as that.
If you'd like to support the work of the AFA and receive a fixed income for life, a charitable gift annuity from the AFA Foundation may just be what you're looking for. Learn more by contacting the Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
When it comes to the political process, can we believe one way and vote another way? The short answer, of course not. This is Jim Garlow. I ask a politician, are you pro-life? Yes, he said. I ask, suppose there's a tie vote on Roe v. Wade overturning the legislation that allows doctors to perform abortions legally. How would you vote? He said, I'd vote to continue it and keep it legally. Then don't tell me you're pro-life, I said. And he said, oh, but I am personally. If you're personally pro-life, but you're not legislatively doing anything about it, you're worthless to that preborn baby. You can't believe one way and vote another way as a politician, or for that matter, as a private citizen. In a monarchy or dictatorship, people can do nothing about the government. But in a representative form of government, a democracy, we vote politicians into power. What you believe should determine how you vote. For more, go to jimgarlow.com.
If you're low on the FM dial looking for NPR, go no further. We're actually going to tell you the truth here. That's our intent anyway. And if you think we're not, you can call us at 888-589-8840. 888-589-8840. We're talking about the most obvious evidence for God, yet the most resisted. And the most obvious evidence for God and most resisted is the fact that there's a moral law, that there's a conscience, that we all intuitively know some things are objectively right and other things are objectively wrong. Now, before we get back to your phone calls, let me point out a couple of misunderstandings when it comes to this particular argument for God. We are not saying that atheists don't know morality. Atheists know morality just like everybody else. It's written on their heart. In fact, the Bible teaches that you don't have to be a Christian or even believe in God to know right and wrong. The Bible teaches that. Romans chapter 2, verses 14 to 15. The Gentiles who don't have the law written on their hearts. Thomas Jefferson, of course, put that into our Declaration of Independence this way when he said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. These are self-evident truths. You know them. As soon as you're old enough, as Kenny mentioned earlier, you hit the age of accountability, you intuitively understand right from wrong. Now, you can be talked out of it. You can be miseducated out of that. Your conscience can be seared, but everybody, once they're old enough to know what, say, murder is, they know that murder is wrong. As I say, bad education can get you to doubt that, but it's written on your heart. Also, we're not saying that you have to believe in God to be a good person in a moral sense, or that there are atheists out there that aren't moral. There are many atheists out there that live moral lives. So I'm not saying you can't be moral or you can't know morality. What I'm saying is that atheists can't justify morality. They can act morally and judge some actions to be moral and others immoral, but they can provide no objective basis for those judgments. I mean, whether we're talking about stealing, raping, murdering, the Holocaust, whatever, they have no objective standard by which to judge any of it. So that's the point. And you'll hear atheists all the time making this mistake. They try and say, well, I know morality because society taught it to me, or evolution taught it to me, or Evolution can't explain why life got here. It certainly can't explain why morality got here, but more on that later. Or they try and say, well, my parents taught it to me, or, you know, we wouldn't get along. We wouldn't be able to cooperate. We wouldn't have a society if we didn't have these moral principles. All of that misses the point. The point isn't how you know something. The point isn't, well, it's pragmatic if we do this. The point is that there is no standard of objective morality. It's not how you know something. It's why does the moral law exist if there is no God? Who said murder's wrong if there is no God? You? What, do you have authority over everybody else in the universe? No, you don't. You see, if there's no standard beyond humanity, then everything is reduced to human opinion. It's just your opinion against, say, Hitler's opinion. In fact, in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, we have a chapter. It's called Mother Teresa versus Hitler. And the point is that, and for those of you who are too young to remember, Mother Teresa was the Catholic nun who devoted her life to caring for the poor and suffering in Calcutta, India, whereas Hitler, of course, was the mass murder dictator of World War II. One of the mass murder dictators of World War II. Stalin was another one, not to mention Mussolini. In any event, why is Mother Teresa better than Hitler? Because there's a standard beyond both of them, Mother Teresa and Hitler, by which we judge both of them. And that standard is God's very nature. If God doesn't exist, then you just have two opinions. You have Mother Teresa's opinion versus Hitler's opinion. We all intuitively understand that there really was something wrong with Hitler. And there really was something right in terms of her moral behavior of Mother Teresa. Why? Because there's a standard beyond both of them. Now, for them to say, for atheists to say, well, I know it, therefore that solves the problem. Knowing it is not the same as explaining why it exists. I mean, I agree that atheists can know objective morality while they deny God exists, but that's like saying you can know what a book says while denying there's an author. Of course you can do that, but there would be no book to know unless there was an author. Likewise, atheists can know objective morality while denying God exists, but there would be no objective morality unless God exists. So this is the standard that everybody knows. Everybody knows because it really exists. It's really out there. In fact, C.S. Lewis has done some work on this, as you know. His book, Mere Christianity, is probably one of the best things ever written in the modern times about it, where he talks about there really is a moral law and everybody understands it. And he did some previous work on this in a book called The Abolition of Man, where he looked into all these different cultures and discover there is a common moral code, even though there are some differences, quite obviously. There's a common moral code out there. Everybody knows it, and it really exists. So this argument, I think, is the most, we might say, existentially relevant argument, meaning it has the most personal impact on us, and we have the most experience with it. Yeah, of course, we know there's a creator out there, but a creator for some people can be distant. The moral law is within, and we deal with it every day. And so that's why I mentioned at the top of the show, there are some apologists, particularly somebody like Ravi Zacharias. And if you've ever heard anything Ravi Zacharias has said or anything Ravi Zacharias has written, you realize he's using the moral law to get people to understand what they already know. They just don't know they know it. There is a moral standard out there, and that moral standard is God's very nature. In fact, Ravi, as you know, is a great speaker, great writer. In fact, it's been put this way. Anything Ravi writes, God reads. Okay? Because a lot of people will listen to a Ravi Zacharias, and they won't listen to somebody like me or somebody who's more, I guess, Western in their thought. Ravi Zacharias is originally from India, and he has an accent, and he's a brilliant mind, and he weaves stories together so well that people are mesmerized by what he says. And quite frequently, of course, they should be, because he says so many profound things. So if you don't know about Ravi Zacharias, I highly recommend you go to his website, rzim.org, or you can just go to YouTube and call him up. You'll see someone who you'll be mesmerized by. And he's admitted to me that his main approach, of course, is the moral law, because everybody knows it. It's written on their hearts. I mean, you can deny it. We all deny it. Even Christians deny it. But it's there. 888-589-8840, 888-589-8840, if you'd like to join the conversation. Now, let me deal with a couple of these objections that atheists bring up to the moral law. The one that they bring up more than any other is what I just mentioned. It's not really an objection. Well, it is an objection, but it's really a confusion. When they say because they know it, that explains it. And stay with me on this. This is important. That's the distinction, or I should say a confusion, between epistemology and ontology. Epistemology is how you know something. Ontology is the study of being, that it actually exists. You might come to know morality in all sorts of different ways. As I mentioned earlier, through your family, through the fact that it's written on your heart, through society, through a whole number of different ways you can come to know morality. But just because you come to know it, that doesn't explain why it exists. I mean, I came to know the times tables by my fourth grade teacher, Mr. Fisher. He taught them to me. But the times tables existed independent of me or Mr. Fisher. In other words, 4 times 4 = 16 before I ever existed or before Mr. Fisher ever existed. Before I came to know it, it was true. Because there's a standard out there. And I think the idea that there are mathematical laws and logical laws point back to a mind. These unchanging laws of math, these unchanging laws of logic point back to an unchanging mind. That's what we mean by God. So they're there. How I came to know them is epistemology. It does not explain why they're there. And atheists mess this up all the time. They confuse this. They confuse epistemology and ontology. In fact, Sam Harris does that in his book called The Moral Landscape. He's actually an atheist who believes in objective morality. Most atheists are honest to say, look, if there's no God, there's no objective morality. In fact, in my debate with David Silverman, which you can see on our website for free, crossexamine.org, Silverman gets to the point in the conversation where he says, no, we can't judge the Nazis as being wrong. That's the hard answer to your question, because I kept saying, well, wait a minute. Are you saying that if there's no objective morality, there's no way to judge the Nazis? He said, yeah, there's no way to judge the Nazis. He said, now look, if your worldview causes you to believe that murdering 6 million Jews and experimenting on children is not morally wrong, you have the wrong worldview. I mean, what's more obvious? That murdering and experimenting, torturing children is wrong, or atheism's true? What's more obvious? I think it's more obvious that murdering, raping, torturing children is wrong than it is that atheism is true. In fact, Louise Anthony, who debated William Lane Craig on this issue, she's an atheist. But she admitted something in the debate. She said, quote, any argument for moral skepticism will be based upon premises which are less obvious than the existence of objective moral values themselves, unquote. She's exactly right. That it's more obvious that it's wrong to torture babies for fun than it is that atheism's true. If it's more obvious that it's wrong to torture babies for fun than atheism's true, then it's unreasonable to be an atheist. Of course, it's unreasonable for a number of other reasons, too, but it's just unreasonable because you're believing in something that's far less obvious than something that's very obvious, and that is, of course, that there are certain moral rights and wrongs. Indeed, objective moral rights are self-evident. Atheism is not. So, let me go back to Sam Harris. I'll get to Sam Harris after the phone calls, which we'll take right after the break. I don't want to forget about Sam Harris. But if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-589-8840. 888-589-8840. I also want to mention to you, friends, it's early here in the new year, 2014. This June, we're heading to Israel. And we're going to go to some amazing places in Israel. In fact, we're actually going to go to all the great places you always go to in Israel, Galilee, and of course, Jerusalem and Jericho and all those great places. We're also going to go to a Dead Sea Spa right in the middle of the trip to get a little R&R. because it can be a tiring trip. Check it out on our website, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. I'm Frank Turk, back in 2 minutes.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, and we are ready to go in 2014 with our spiritual heritage tours this year of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon, and then a separate trip to Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. You can join us for one or the other or both of the tours because they are back-to-back in June and September. American history comes to life. Joining us for these tours will be Stephen McDowell, the president and founder of the Providence Foundation, who will give us an accurate look at history and the Christian influence on early American history. So it's going to be a wonderful time in our nation's capital and a separate trip to Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. If you would like information on either of these tours, give us a call for a free brochure at 800-FAMILIES, 1-800-FAMILIES, or go online at spiritualheritagetours.com. That's spiritualheritagetours.com.
How many people would quickly raise their hand to say, yes, I'm a Christian, but when you try to engage them about Christ himself, nobody's impressed with him?
Jordan Thomas from Behold Your God, Rethinking God Biblically.
The way to appreciate the loveliness of Christ, to really be able to see and behold him, we have the answer from the heart of God himself, which is, we all with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image. Well, how does that transformation into the image of Christ happen? It's beholding his glory in the mirror. 2 Corinthians 3, and the mirror, of course, is his word. So how do I try to look to him? I try to look to him humbly in prayer through the scriptures to behold his glory. I want to see his glory in Christ.
Find out more about the Behold Your God study at beholdyourgod.org. That's beholdyourgod.org.
Welcome back to Cross Examined with Frank Turk on the AFR Talk Radio Network. What is the most obvious yet suppressed evidence for God? And that, of course, is the moral law written within. We all know it's there, and it's there because God has put it on our hearts. And, of course, even if he didn't put it on our hearts, it's still there. There are certain things that are objectively right and other things that are objectively wrong. If that's the case, God must exist, because there are no objective, unchanging moral values in the absence of an unchanging, authoritative, objective God. Everything's just reduced to a matter of opinion. I don't have enough faith to believe that. All right, let's get back to your phone calls. 888-589-8840, 888-589-8840. If you'd like to join the program, let's start with Buck in North Carolina. Buck, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead, sir. Buck, can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Go right ahead, sir. You're on. Go ahead.
Frank, I just want to put a bug in here. Why do so many agnostics and atheists believe in, they cannot believe in a God who they can find, but yet they know so much about stuff they can't know about?
Such as?
Well, evolution. They say it's a fact when they know in their heart of hearts, they know it's a lie.
I would say it depends on what you mean by evolution, because if they're talking about microevolution, it's not a lie. It's true. You can witness that.
Oh, yeah, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, macroevolution. Yeah, there are so many problems with it that it just doesn't line up with the evidence that we see. I agree with you on that. And actually, Buck, you may be surprised to know this, that some evolutionists have admitted that the reason they believe in evolution, in fact, it was Aldous Huxley who famously said, the reason that we believe in Darwinism without proof is because a creator interferes with our sexual mores. In other words, a creator gets involved in our sex life, and we don't want that to happen. Now, that's obviously not true of all, but some atheists have admitted that. That's one reason that Darwinism is so popular.
Well, maybe I didn't paint too broad a brush here, but I'm just talking about the ones that are so emphatically against creation that they will entertain any kind of idea that they cannot possibly know and still yet claim it's a fact. You know what I'm saying?
Well, it is interesting. It depends what you mean by know. they can't demonstrate it empirically in the laboratory. Nobody's ever been able to demonstrate that one type of creature can turn into another type of creature. In fact, there's been experiments done, like Richard Lenski, I think he's at Michigan State University, has been working with E. coli bacteria for about the past 25 years, and E. coli bacteria have a very short generational lifespan. And so he's been able to work on, I think, about 60 or so thousand generations of these E. coli bacteria, which would be equivalent to about 1 million years of human life or human evolution. And after these 60,000 generations, he still has E. coli bacteria. There's been some minor abilities that have changed over the lifetime of these generations, but there's still E. coli bacteria. He hasn't been able to show a macroevolutionary change. He's been able to show microevolutionary change. And so in one sense, you can detect microevolution, but you can't detect macroevolution. It's a forensic science. It's an historical science, just like you could say creation is. You can't go back and recreate the world or recreate the first life. All you can do is look at clues that have been left over and draw an inference to the best explanation from those clues. And I think when you look at the evidence from those clues, the inference to the best explanation should be there was some sort of intelligent being involved, because these things could not have come into existence by natural forces. And there's evidence within the beings that point positively to an intelligent being. For example, the genetic code comes from a coder. All codes come from coders. All messages come from minds. And so when we see that, we're not just arguing from what we don't know, we're arguing from what we do know. So I agree with you, Buck. They can't know in a empirical way. They can only know in a forensic way. And when you look at the forensic evidence, I think you should come to the conclusion an intelligent being was involved.
This is your whole point. Your whole point is, once they do find a truth, they suppress it and say, it can't be that. It just can't
be
that. It's got to be something else. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I know what you're saying, because what they've done is they've presupposed that an intelligent being can't be the cause, because they philosophically ruled out intelligent causes in advance. They've said the only causes we consider possible, the only causes we'll consider scientific, are natural causes. Well, if they've already rigged the game at the get-go, from the get-go, then obviously they're never going to come to a conclusion that an intelligent being was involved, if indeed an intelligent being was involved, because they philosophically ruled him out before they started the experiment or before they started to look at the evidence. So it's more of a philosophical conclusion they've come to, rather than simply looking at the evidence and being open to where it might lead. Good call, Buck. Thank you very much. 888-589-8840. 888-589-8840. And see, so often the motivation is what drives the scientific conclusion. Now, motivation doesn't make something true or false. I mean, you can have bad motives and still believe something that's true. And of course, you can have good motives and still believe something that's false. But quite often, motives can be involved and might lead you down the wrong path. And as I mentioned earlier, many atheists have been honest with this. They've admitted that there is a problem. I mentioned Aldous Huxley. Somebody even more prevalent than Huxley was, of course, Friedrich Nietzsche, probably the only real atheist who ever lived out the implications of atheism, that there is no value to anything. Nietzsche famously wrote, "God is dead and we've killed him," because he said we've killed belief in God. And he wrote this back in the late 1800s. And he said the 1900s will be the most bloody century in history. And he was right. He predicted it. Why? Because if you kill belief in God, you kill belief in objective right and wrong, then people can do whatever they want, like try and eradicate people they don't like, the undesirables, like Hitler did. In fact, Hitler used Darwinism to try and justify evolution. And that's exactly what we saw in the 20th century. It was the bloodiest century in history because we killed belief in God. Anyway, Nietzsche said, in addition to saying God is dead and we've killed him, he said, if anyone, listen to this. He said, if one were to prove this God of the Christians to us, we should believe him all the less. What? If you provide proof for God, we ought not believe in him? We ought not trust in him? His objection to Christianity was not intellectual. It was moral or volitional. He didn't want it to be true, which is what Thomas Nagel, a famous atheist from NYU, wrote back in 1997. He said, I want atheism to be true, and I am made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't want, or let me say it exactly. I bungled the quote here. I'm quoting from Thomas Nagel, an atheist at NYU, New York University, philosopher. He said, it isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. My guess is that this cosmic authority problem is not a rare condition and that it is responsible for much of the scientism and reductionism of our time, unquote. The cosmic authority problem. We don't want there to be a God. Nagel admits he has it, and he thinks it's responsible for us thinking that we get all our truth from science and everything can be reduced to materials, which is the scientific rule that there can be no intelligence out there. Everything just happens by natural causes. Everything is material. Everything is can be reduced to matter, to molecules. And as we've pointed out on this show before, if that's true, then we can't know anything because we're just molecules in motion. We're not really reasoning. We're just reacting. You see, the universal acid that destroys our ability to know anything is materialism because it makes everything just molecules in motion. We're not really free will creatures. We're just reacting to everything. So many atheists have admitted this, that they have this objection to God. In fact, Richard Dawkins calls God a malevolent bully and admits that he is, quote, hostile to religion, unquote. I mean, why else would Dawkins, the eminent scientist, the guy who thinks that science is preeminent, lace his book, The God Delusion, with caustic moralistic rants against the biblical God? Why not just stick with science? Because the issue is morality. It's not science. Christopher Hitchens and Lawrence Krauss both have admitted implicitly to the cosmic authority problem because they label themselves anti-theists. They're not just atheists. They just don't. Lack a belief in God, as some atheists have said, oh, we just lack a belief in God. They're positively against God. Hitchens called God a cosmic North Korean dictator who peered into our sex lives. And for that reason, he said that he wouldn't live under, quote, the tyranny of a divine dictatorship. Now, Hitchens was brilliant. He was great to listen to, very witty. You can see both of the debates I've had with him on our website for free, crossexamine.org. But really, his book is short on evidence and long on attitude, which is why I concluded both of my debates with Christopher this way. I said, you can sum up Christopher Hitchens' book in one sentence. Here it is. There is no God, and I hate him. I think Doug Wilson probably said that originally, although I'm not sure he's the original source. But he's just mad at God. There is no God, and I hate him. Now, let me go back to your phone calls. We'll start with Murphy in Tennessee. Murphy, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Turek, for taking this call. Really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I have a question for you or maybe a comment regarding the morality, the morals that are written upon our hearts. Mm-hmm. If that is true, and I'm a Bible-believing Christian and I believe it 100%, where does the morality of the founders of the Third Reich or Lenin and Stalin and their cohorts and Pol Pot and Ho Chi Minh and his associates, where do they find their morality? And if it does come from the state, as they state it does, where is their foundation? Thank you so much.
Well, that's an excellent question, Murphy. There is no foundation. That's the problem. In Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, he basically said if the weak don't want to struggle for existence, they have no right to exist. So Hitler wanted to create the super race by getting rid of the undesirables. And in his mind, the undesirables were, of course, the Jews, homosexuals, gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, anybody's handicapped. Because why? These people, according to him, were taking resources away from the Aryan race. And so we've got to eradicate the Aryan race, or not eradicate, we want to create the Aryan race or enhance the Aryan race. We want to eradicate these undesirables in order to provide more resources for the Aryan race, the super race. So there is no foundation. That's why Dostoevsky's novel, in the novel, he said, if there is no God, everything is permitted. And Hitler just took that. He said, yeah, everything's permitted. I can do whatever I want to create what I think is good, this super race. So there's no standard if God doesn't exist. We're on our own. That's the scary part. 888-589-8840. I'm Frank Turek, back in two.
This is Jan Mark Hill, and I try to help you understand the times each week here on American Family Radio Talk Network. I believe we need to discern the times, and the Bible says we're to contend for the faith. Let me do that with you every Sunday at noon Central Time. That's Understanding the Times Radio with me, Jan Mark Hill, each week, and my goal is to make you a watchman on the wall.
Kevin McCullough.
Marriage is not a union between a man and a woman.
What?
That's not what marriage is.
AFA Today.
Marriage is a picture of the redemptive gospel of Jesus and his church. The picture of a husband and a wife coming together in marriage is the picture of Jesus redeeming his church.
Injecting Christ and biblical values into the national dialogue. AFA Today. Weekdays at noon Central on AFR Talk.
My name's Garrett, and a few years ago, I went through one of those life-shattering events as I watched my marriage crumble and I became a statistic of divorce. Now, there were some pretty dark days. How could a Christian guy get divorced? I mean, I was the guy who told others how faithful God was. And then all of a sudden, my shortcomings were made public, and there I was, a statistic. Then a couple of great guys reminded me of what God's Word says about a bunch of men and women who goofed up, messed up, and even went through rough stuff like divorce. Isn't that just like God to say, hey, I love you anyway, even if you are divorced? Well, today I still don't have it all together, but I do know that Jesus has changed me, restored me, and I'm becoming the dad and the new husband that he wants me to be. If you're there today and you don't think there's any hope, think again. Jesus is ready to spend some time with you on the road to restoration. You can meet him right now. Just call 888-NEED-HIM or chat with us live at needhim.org.
Welcome back to Cross Examine with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. We're talking about the moral law today. That there is evidence out there that God exists. Some of the most obvious evidence, of course, is the moral law, yet it's the most suppressed. And we're taking your phone calls on that. And I want to find a quote here. I'm looking it up right here. So hold on. Stand by for Vectors, Victor, because I remember that. Speaking of Ravi Zacharias, he often quotes this, and of course he has it by memory. Yeah, written on a wall at Auschwitz. One source claims that this is written on a wall in Auschwitz. Let me see. This is what Hitler said, and this is in the Holocaust Museum as well. Quote, I want to raise a generation of young people who are devoid of conscience, imperious, relentless, and cruel. Wow. And if you've ever visited a concentration camp, as I have, you realize that they were devoid of conscience. You can talk people out of right and wrong. You can get them to suppress it. You can dehumanize people and get them to murder those people. And that's what Hitler did. All right, let me go back to the phone lines. Who's been waiting the longest here? It looks like Jim. Jim, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead, sir.
Hey, Dr. Turek. How you doing?
Great, sir, but I'll get better. How are you this new year?
Oh, outstanding.
All right.
Yeah, I've been watching you quite a bit on the NRB network. I don't know
yes.
how recent those programs are, but mm-hmm. I know a few months back they showed you giving a message on, I want to say it was like love and marriage or parenting and marriage maybe. And I just thought that was outstanding. I just wanted to tell you that. It was one of the best things I've watched in a while, like that, one of the best messages I've heard.
Oh, thanks. I think that was probably the show we call A Father's Embrace when it deals with reasons to be married and reasons not to get divorced. Was that it?
It seemed like it was more general about just being married, you know, having a wife and how to raise children, et cetera, it seems like.
Yeah, it was probably
a couple years old. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was. I think it's called A Father's Embrace. So if those of you are interested in that message, it's available on our website. You go to crossexamine.org, click on store. And also, glad you brought up the TV program, Jim. We're on Saturday night, so we're on tonight, DirecTV Channel 378 at 10 p.m. If you don't have DirecTV, you can watch the show from our website live. And also, we're on Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern time for a different episode of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. But go ahead, Jim. You had another comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to – this is kind of a departure, I guess, from the topic that we're talking about with the moral law, but – when it comes to the fossil record, how does the atheist ignore such a, or dismiss such a, what seems to be an impossible obstacle, which is the fact that the fossil record has no transitional forms in it? What if there were transitional forms, if we're molecules to man, as Kim Ham likes to say, why do we not see any of those forms going on today, or why are there no forms like that in the fossil record?
Well, that's one of the great problems with Darwinism, macroevolution, and that's why Stephen Meyer wrote the book Darwin's Doubt, where he talked about how about 20 of 28 of the major phyla immediately seemed to appear in the Cambrian explosion without fossil precursors. And Darwin even knew this, and he thought that future fossil discoveries would find all these transitional forms. Well, here we are 150 or so years later, and no, that's not the case. We haven't found these transitional forms. And so this remains one of the greatest mysteries for Darwinists, the fossil record. It does not show gradualism. In fact, that's why Stephen Jay Gould, the great evolutionist from Harvard University, came up with a different theory other than gradualistic Darwinism. He called it punctuated equilibria, where he had these great jumps from one type to another type. There were no fossil intermediates. They just kind of jumped from one type to another type. And he just said that that's the way the fossil record show, or that's what the fossil record shows us. But of course, he has no mechanism by which these creatures could take such a jump. So there really isn't a good answer, Jim. That's just one of the mysteries.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I mean, to me, if we're descendants of a lower order, apes, anything else, what have you, would we not see examples of that? Would we not see living beings of that going on today?
Living beings in what sense? What do you mean?
For example, we'll take the most obvious one, humans from apes. Would we not see a transitional form living today? Someone that we could point to and say,
I see what you're saying.
And he's a transitional form.
Well, actually, it's quite often misunderstood. Darwinists don't believe that we came from apes necessarily. They believe there's a common ancestor from which both men and apes have come. That's why it's called the missing link, okay? But all this is speculation, because when you look at the evidence, you don't see that. So whether you'd see someone living today who would be a common ancestor between man and apes, they would say, well, no, that whatever that being was has gone extinct. So I wouldn't tend to argue with them that way. I think the better arguments against Darwinism are what you mentioned earlier, the lack of fossil transitions. Even if you grant them there's a common ancestor, you can't find any evidence for that in the fossil record, because you wouldn't just have to find, quite obviously, a common ancestor between man and apes, or you'd have to find an incredible array of fossils for all creatures, because according to their theory, common descent means that we're all ultimately related. There's this great tree out there, and so you'd have to find transitional forms between all of the major types of creatures, and we don't find that at all. In fact, it's been put this way: if you look at the fossil record, you don't see a tree; you see a lawn. If you want to use a botanical illustration, you see all these phyla just branching up individually, like blades of grass, rather than a tree. So I would argue that way. Thanks for the call, Jim. Let me move on to Roger in Texas. Roger, I'm with Frank Turek. Go right ahead, sir.
Hi. I just catch your show, and I find you very insightful, and it's a bright thing to hear you. So, but I wanted to make a point that
yes,
I learned. I studied philosophy and some theology, and I've come to the conclusion, and it strikes true to me, that human beings are essentially creatures of faith. In other words, faith comes even before reason. We, when Christ says that we are to be children before God, that actually has a deep theological implication to it. It means that God created us to have, for faith to be at the forefront of our being. So we either believe in God or we don't. All the intellectual projects that we come up with, whether atheistic, whether theological, all of it presupposes first this free will that God gives us. He gives us the free will either to accept or reject him as our creator.
Yes, sir.
And all our intellectual projects tumble, you might say, from that first faith act of the will. So you cannot say you can even prove a moral law, because a moral law can only be proven if those who hear it are actually have a disposition to accept their creator. Only then will the moral law have force for them. Those who have a disposition to reject their creator will find no force in the moral law, and they will attempt to create atheistic worldviews, which, like you say in the beginning, it presupposes a disbelief in the creator.
Yes, I think you are correct that we are predisposed to believe in God because there is a creator, so there's a creation, so we know there must be a creator. We know God by his effects. We know there's a conscience, so there must be a moral lawgiver. We have to suppress those truths in order to say God does not exist. So God has implanted in us through what we call natural revelation concepts that he does exist, and then if we take a step toward those truths, God will get us more information so we can be saved, the gospel. So I agree with you, Roger, it's there. But as I say, we can deny it, we can suppress it to try and go our own way, because God gives us the free will to do so, and he won't force anybody into his presence against his will. Let me point out one thing too, Roger, that you bring up the idea of faith. There's a clarification I think we need to make with faith. I was watching a football game last night. I think I was watching the Orange Bowl, and the commentator said the coach has faith in his quarterback in the red zone. Of course, right after he said that, the guy threw an interception. But anyway, he has faith. Now, why did he have faith? Faith wasn't this blind idea that he has no evidence. It meant that he had trust in this quarterback because he has evidence that the quarterback does well in the red zone. It's not a belief without evidence. It's a belief in the evidence. It's a trust in what you know to be true. And this is so often brought up by atheists. They think we have belief without evidence. No, we have belief because of the evidence, that we trust in God because we have evidence that he exists and he is who he says he is. So don't buy into this idea, and I'm not talking to you, Roger, like you'd buy into it. I'm talking to the audience in general. Don't buy into this idea that faith is belief without evidence. You see, there's belief that's evidence that God exists, and then there's belief in, better stated, trust in. After you know that he exists and who he is, then you trust in him for your salvation. And I've put this before, and by the way, Roger, thank you so much for your call. I've put this before this way. That when I first met my wife, I got evidence that she'd be a good wife, but all the evidence in the world didn't make her my wife. I then had to take a step of trust in her to ask her to be my wife. And in a momentary lapse of judgment, she said yes. You see, so there's a difference between belief that and belief in. Everybody knows that God exists. You have to suppress the truth about it in order to say he doesn't. But not everybody trusts in him. Why? Because God gives you the free will to go your own way. He will not force you into heaven against your will. If you don't want God now, you're not going to want him in eternity. Now, morality is one insight that God exists. If you take a step toward it, you'll get more information that God truly is there to save you. You've broken his law and he can save you. I'm Frank Turek. Thanks for tuning in today. Crossexamine.org is our website. Crossexamine with a D on the end of it. .org. Check it out. See you next week. God bless.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.